sobering numbers here. 2.2 million people incarcerated in America. It amounts to a 500% increase in 40 years. Those are the latest figures from the Sentencing Project. How did we get here? Michael O'Hare joins us. He's a law professor at Marquette University, author of the new book due out next week titled Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era, How Judges Retain Power and Why Mass Incarceration Happened Anyway. Michael, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Why, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we dig in any further here, set the scene for us. What is the state of mass incarceration in Wisconsin?
Well, in Wisconsin, we began growing our prison population in the early 1970s and grew it really without interruption for 30 solid years. The prison population finally peaked in about 2007, where it is right now, and it really hasn't come down from that peak very much at all. Where it is now is about 22,000, a little over 22,000, which compares with just over 2,000 in the early 1970s. So you're really looking at a prison population that's settled into a level that's about 10 times higher than it was before the imprisonment boom began.
And during the 1990s, there was a boom in building prisons in Wisconsin. Did that contribute to incarceration?
Well, I think it was more a response to incarceration. Mm. Our prisons were getting filled up. We were having some pretty significant overcrowding issues. And so those pressures really required the state to go on a prison building spree. So there was a tremendous buildup in the state's prison capacity in the 90s. Actually, though, that buildup could not keep pace with the increase in the size of the prison population. So by the late 1990s, Wisconsin was shipping about a quarter of its prisoners out of state to private prisons in Tennessee, Oklahoma, and other places. And it wasn't until after 2000 that the state's own prison capacity finally caught up with the size of the prison population, and those out-of-state prisoners were brought back home.
So you've taken the historical, the long view. What can we attribute this mass incarceration to?
Well, it's a combination of different factors. One thing that certainly needs to be kept in mind is that the incarceration boom was associated with a big crime wave, both nationally and in Wisconsin. Crime rates rose pretty sharply and consistently in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. And it was that increase in crime that initially was the major driver for the incarceration boom. What happened in the 90s, though, again, both nationally and in Wisconsin, is that the crime rate stabilized finally, but the incarceration rate kept growing and growing, and that needs to be attributed, that further growth in mass incarceration needs to be attributed to the increasing severity of the system. That, in turn, is a reflection of laws adopted by state legislatures across the country, also increasing severity by prosecutors and judges, and the elimination in a lot of states of parole opportunities. And certainly Wisconsin, through its Truth in Sentencing law, was an example of one of those states that eliminated parole release opportunities.
And discuss with us, explain Truth in Sentencing. What was that?
Yeah, sure. There were a lot of states across the country in the 90s that adopted Truth in Sentencing. Wisconsin's Truth in Sentencing law was adopted in 1998, and it was probably the nation's toughest and most inflexible Truth in Sentencing law. The primary thing that law did is that it eliminated the possibility of parole release for prisoners who committed their crimes on or after December 31st, 1999. prior to that law coming into effect, offenders in Wisconsin who were sent to prison would have their release determined by the parole commission. So the judge would pronounce a sentence, say 10 years in prison. But the actual release date would be determined by the parole commission, and it could be anywhere from the one-quarter mark of the sentence to the two-thirds mark of the sentence. So that's how the parole system used to work. The Truth in Sentencing law eliminated that. Now, there is a common misperception about Wisconsin's Truth in Sentencing law, and that is that it took away the discretion of sentencing judges. And I know from having many conversations around the state over the years that, a lot of people in Wisconsin have the belief that Truth in Sentencing both took away the discretion of the parole commission and took away the discretion of the sentencing judges. But that's not true. There were no sentencing guidelines that came into place with the Truth in Sentencing law. Eventually, the state adopted some advisory sentencing guidelines, but they didn't have much of an impact and were repealed eventually. So Wisconsin sentencing judges never lost their discretion. And that's part of the subtitle of my book.
Yeah, judges making it into the title of your book.
Right, yeah, how judges retained power.
Mm-hmm.
So in Wisconsin, to a greater extent than in many other states, our judges retained power over punishment. In other states, there were much more meaningful sentencing guidelines that were adopted that reduced judicial discretion, or legislatures adopted some very important statutory mandatory minimum sentences that took away the judge's sentencing discretion. We had some of that in Wisconsin, but it just wasn't nearly as important in Wisconsin as it was in, say, California or New York or the federal court system. So our judges retained power. In fact, if anything, our judges really expanded their power in the tough-on-crime era. And one of the most important ways in which they expanded their power was through Truth in Sentencing, because prior to Truth in Sentencing, we had checks and balances in the penal system. The judge would impose a sentence, but the parole commission was a check and balance on the power of the judge. That check and balance doesn't exist anymore. So our judges, our sentencing judges in Wisconsin, really have increased their power, and in comparison with many other states, have a truly extraordinary amount of power over punishment.
We're talking with Michael O'Hare. He's a law professor at Marquette University, author of the new book, Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era. Michael, how has the sentencing latitude for Wisconsin judges, how has that worked out for incarceration in Wisconsin in your research?
Well, Wisconsin's judges over time have increased the severity of the sentences that they've handed out. So they've used their power in ways that have increased mass incarceration. Now, the data don't indicate, by and large, a dramatic change in sentencing practices. So it was more a slow upward drift over a period of many years in the sentences that that judges were imposing for a whole variety of different crimes. When Truth in Sentencing came into place, there was a hope, and among some people, I suppose, an expectation that judges would adjust their sentences downward in order to compensate for the fact that parole release would no longer be available on the back end of the
mm-hmm.
sentence. To some extent, judges did do that, but not nearly to the extent that would have been required in order to fully offset the loss of the parole release opportunity. And one way in particular in which this has been important is that under Truth in Sentencing, Wisconsin judges decide not only an initial term of confinement, but also a period of extended supervision in the community after release from prison, during which time offenders can be quickly and easily returned to prison if they violate any of the rules of release. Those periods of post-prison supervision have grown pretty sharply under Truth in Sentencing, and that's contributed to the revocation problem that we have in the state. We're sending a tremendous number of offenders back into prison after they've been initially released from prison. And in many cases, those returns to prison are not for the commission of new crimes, but instead for technical violations of the requirements of release.
More people incarcerated in America than any other country in the world. We're learning about the history of sentencing in Wisconsin with our guest, Michael O'Hare. He teaches law at Marquette University and has a new book on Wisconsin sentencing in the tough-on-crime era, the role of judges through the decades. And we want to hear from you. Are judges too powerful? What do you think about incarceration here in Wisconsin? How do you think we should fix the criminal justice system? Does it need fixing at all? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be back right after this. Stay with us. Prisons are at a crossroads. How did Wisconsin get to 22,000 people behind bars? What about treatment and diversion programs? Do they hold down sentences for nonviolent crimes? We're looking at sentencing this hour with Marquette University law professor Michael O'Hare. He's author of Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Joy Cardine. Do join us in this conversation on incarceration and the role of judges, 800-642-1234, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's go to Gil now in Madison. Hi, Gil.
Hi. I have a question for the professor about the increase in power of the judges and the impact that that's having on judges, because I have heard lots of judges complain about the change to truth in sentencing because I guess my sense is that that they know they're sentencing someone to a determinate length of time during which there's no opportunity, as there was before, for a prisoner to improve himself in prison and thereby reduce his sentence. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I think that you are absolutely right that judges are aware that they exercise more power in the system. And from my conversations with judges around the state, I think that they are very mindful of that and trying to exercise their power appropriately. They have not, however, by and large, supported guidelines that might help to that might help them to exercise that that power in ways that would be cost effective for the state. I think that one thing that's really missing in Wisconsin that would be helpful in comparison to other jurisdictions is what are referred to as presumptive sentencing guidelines. So guidelines that give the judges information about what factors are important in sentencing, and you could have guidelines. You should have guidelines that relate sentences to objectively determined risk categories for defendants. So, in other words, we want to make sure that we're reserving prison for the people who really need to be in prison. And if there are effective ways of supervising or treating an offender in the community, that should be strongly preferred, because that's a much more cost-effective way of responding to crime for many offenders. So, ideally, a state would have sentencing guidelines that use the best available research, use data to connect sentences to risk assessment and risk management.
Well, thank you, Gil, for your call. Let's go to Jacob now in Burlington. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I read the book, The New Jim Crow, and I forget the author's name, but I believe it's a woman. She specified that, you know, the get tough on particularly black crime and black drug crime in the 90s and 2000s really spiked the racial imbalance and the high rate of minority incarceration in this country. And I'm wondering if you could address that in terms of the racial disparity in Wisconsin.
Jacob, that's a really important issue. In Wisconsin and nationally, there are huge racial disparities in incarceration. And in fact, in Wisconsin, by some measures, we may have the very worst racial disparities in the country. In particular, when we talk about racial disparities, we're really talking about African Americans. And African Americans in Wisconsin and nationally do have really shockingly high rates of incarceration, especially young African American men. The book that you're referring to, The New Jim Crow, is written by Michelle Alexander, and it's a very important book. It's drawn a lot of attention to the issues of racial disparities, and I think Michelle Alexander has a lot of good things, helpful, important things to say in that book. I do think that she gets some things maybe not exactly right, and maybe these are more secondary matters. But one thing that you mentioned, Jacob, is the war on drugs as a driver of mass incarceration, and that's not right. The war on drugs has played into mass incarceration, but it's not been a primary driver of mass incarceration. And this is true nationally. It's also true in Wisconsin. The percentage of offenders in Wisconsin prisons who are serving time for drug offenses rose in the 1990s significantly, but it topped out at about 15%. And since then, that number has been dropping. And last I saw, it's now below 10%. The common perception that our prisons are full of nonviolent drug offenders is not an accurate perception. It's been other things. It's been violent crime. It's been sexual offenses, it's been firearms offenses and things like that that have contributed more to mass incarceration. But maybe this is a secondary point. The primary point that Michelle Alexander makes is a very important and powerful one, and that is the racial disparities point, that African Americans are greatly overrepresented in our state and national prison populations relative to their share of the general population.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And Michael, you say that Wisconsin's prison population has been holding steady at about 22,000 for more than a decade. Should Wisconsinites be satisfied with that?
No, I don't think so. I think we could be doing a lot better. And a point of comparison that many people have made, and I think it's a very good one, is Minnesota. Our neighbor to the west is a state that's demographically very similar to Wisconsin, and it's a state that for many years had a very similar incarceration rate. But beginning in the 1970s, the two states had rapidly diverging incarceration rates, and Minnesota's is about half of Wisconsin's now and has been for about 30 years. So we have very different incarceration rates. Minnesota makes much heavier use of probation as a sentencing alternative than Wisconsin does. But the crime rates of the two states have been pretty well moving in sync through this entire period of time. So it does not appear that Wisconsin's heavier reliance on incarceration has done much from a public safety standpoint. And Minnesota's getting a pretty big fiscal benefit by emphasizing probation and community supervision much more heavily than Wisconsin is. And we can also look at the experience of other states. There are a few states nationally that in the last 10 or 20 years have achieved some pretty significant reductions in incarceration without any corresponding increases in crime rates. And the really dramatic story in recent years has been the California story. Mm. California dropped about a quarter of its prison population in just 6 years. Extraordinary accomplishment. And during that period of time, crime rates went down. They did not go up.
What could Wisconsin then learn from California?
Well, the overriding lesson is that you can reduce incarceration rates and do it pretty quickly without necessarily having a big impact on public safety. Now, I suppose I should add a caveat about the California story, which is that California had a lot of low-hanging fruit because the excesses of the mass incarceration era, the tough-on-crime era, were especially pronounced in California. So they had a lot of nonviolent offenders in prison who was fairly easy to move out of prison. And Wisconsin doesn't have quite that luxury. Still, if you look at California, if you look at New York, if you look at New Jersey, if you look at what's been happening in the federal system under President Obama, you get a lot of evidence that incarceration rates can be reduced in a significant way without an adverse effect on public safety.
We're assessing where sentencing is headed in the future and what happened in the past with Marquette University law professor Michael O'Hare. He blogs at lifesentencesblog.com, has a new book out this month published by University of Wisconsin Press on criminal sentencing, taking this historical look at how mass incarceration happened. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Don in La Crosse. Hi, Don. Oh, Don, are you there, Don?
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
What would you like to add to this conversation?
I just think there are too many laws on the books that aren't needed. If somebody commits a violent crime, if somebody robs you, if somebody does violence to you or threatens you, yes.
But you...
a lot of drugs on the book, or a lot of laws on the books just seem useless. If you sell drugs to kids, yes, that's a crime. If you sell them to an adult, that's a personal choice between two people.
Michael, how would you respond? Too many laws on the books.
Well, I would agree with Don. I think that's absolutely right. Our criminal codes in Wisconsin and nationally grew pretty dramatically in the tough on crime era, the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. Some people talk about drive-by sentencing laws or drive-by criminal laws. There's some event that happens, some unfortunate event that happens, some crime. It captures the public attention. There's a lot of media coverage, and the tendency is for politicians to want to adopt a law to address that particular problem. That's the crime du jour. And so over time, more and more and more crimes are created, more and more sentencing enhancements are created, criminal codes get longer and longer and longer, more and more complicated. In these new laws, of course, once they're put on the books, are very rarely repealed. Things stay on the books for years and years and years, even long past the point in time when there was a public controversy around the issue. Don particularly mentioned drug laws, and that certainly is an area where there's been a tremendous amount of legislative activity and complexification over the decades. One thing that I did in my book is I have a whole chapter on the war on drugs in Wisconsin, and I tracked changes in the portions of the Wisconsin code that deal with drug sentencing over time. And if you go back to the 1970s, the drug sentencing was pretty straightforward. It took, I counted up, 3 pages of code text to have all of the drug sentencing laws. By the time we got into the 1990s, that had risen to 7 pages, and it was tremendously more complicated, reflecting enactment after enactment after enactment by the legislature to address this or that particular concern relating to drugs.
Well, thank you, Don, for your call. Wisconsin's Corrections Department is one of taxpayers' top costs in the company of K-12 schooling, healthcare, roads, and universities. Michael, what is the impact of cost on severe sentencing, or what is severe sentencing's cost, in terms of budget?
Well, it's been tremendously expensive for Wisconsin and tremendously expensive for the nation as a whole. Incarceration is now costing us about $80 billion annually as a nation. Our state Department of Corrections budget has risen also dramatically over the years, right in line with the increase in the size of the state prison population. This is money which could be spent on other things. There are good reasons to think that money we're pouring into corrections could be better invested in other kinds of programs and services. For instance, policing. There's a lot of research that would suggest that what's most important in deterring crime is not the severity of punishment, but the certainty of punishment. And that research suggests that we would be better off putting money into our police departments, which establish the certainty of apprehension and conviction, rather than pouring it into corrections, which is about the severity of the punishment on the back end.
Let's go to Tom now in Oconto. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. As I told your screener there, that when we were just talking, you were just talking now here about the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment has to go back to maybe as they're doing over in Arizona, where they're just using a very, minimalist style. And they're doing, tents and fences. And, when you go to jail or you go to prison, there is not all these programs. There are not all these luxuries. You're basically, you're going to a cage. And in my thought process, that would do two things. One, that would obviously bring the cost down dramatically. Another thing is, nobody wants to go there. That's going to be a deterrent. It's not going to be a revolving door. You get the criminals off the street, you put them where they belong, and you lower the cost to the taxpayer.
Michael?
Well, I think it is sometimes possible to be penny wise and pound foolish. With our prisons, we have to be focused not only on sending people to prison, but people returning from prison, and whether they are going to be prepared for a successful reentry and reintegration into society. The idea with a lot of the programming available in prisons is to help people to be better prepared to reenter society on the back end. We have to focus on recidivism rates, and recidivism rates have been pretty high nationally, but there is variation from state to state, and some of the states with pretty austere prison experiences have some real problems with recidivism. The research does demonstrate that there is programming which is effective and helpful in prison in helping people to avoid recidivism after their release. And I think we'd probably benefit as a society over the long run to invest in that sort of programming. And I do understand the appeal. There's this kind of intuitive appeal that if you make prison as harsh as possible, that people will be deterred from committing crimes. But the research doesn't really bear out strong deterrence effects. When people commit crimes, they tend not to be engaged in a careful, rational cost-benefit analysis. And people, when they commit crimes, tend to be fairly optimistic that they're not going to be caught. And if you're optimistic that you're not going to be caught, you're not necessarily going to be thinking too much about how harsh the consequences will be if you are caught. As I mentioned earlier, the research shows for deterrence that it's more important to have certainty of punishment than to have high severity of punishment.
Well, yeah, and I'm going to jump in there. Tom, thank you so much for your call. We're going to turn here now to the private prison industry. Steve from Madison would like you, has a question about that.
Yeah, I think of three questions. I'm wondering why that aspect has been neglected so far. I don't know to what extent Wisconsin prisons have been privatized, but I wonder whether their lobbyists, either in-state or out-state, either contribute campaign funding to make sure that sympathetic judges are elected. I don't know to what extent that they have their fingers on the writing of any legislation that would maintain this kind of long prison sentencing.
Well, that's raising a great issue, Steve. The story in Wisconsin is one of public prisons, and there has been some usage of private prisons in the past, particularly during this period of time when we had to ship a lot of our prisoners out of state. But right now, we are not using private prisons to much of an extent. This has been a much bigger issue in other states. There are quite a few other states that rely much more heavily on private for-profit prisons, and that does create powerful incentives for the corporations that run these prisons to lobby for tough-on-crime laws. That definitely has been part of the political dynamic in some other states. My sense in having looked at the Wisconsin history is that political dynamic has been less important here than it has been in some other places.
Thank you so much for that call. We're assessing where sentencing is headed in the future with a look based on what has happened in the past and in mass incarceration with Michael O'Hare. He blogs at lifesentencesblog.com. He's a Marquette University law professor, has a new book out this month on incarceration in Wisconsin sentencing and where it has come from, taking a historical look at how mass incarceration happened. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in prison, a family member, a friend? How has that been? What suggestions do you have for criminal justice? Send an email to talk@wpr.org or 800-642-1234. We're back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Reports out from the state say that actual spending from the Wisconsin Department of Corrections today is essentially flat, the same as it was a decade ago, and spending is actually lower after accounting for inflation. Meanwhile, a youth prison, the Lincoln Hills School for Boys, is under federal investigation for alleged abuses. Michael O'Hare stays with us this hour, taking a deeper look at sentencing law and the role of judges. His new book is Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era. Add your voice to this conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Michael, what would you say about that? Reports out saying spending on corrections is essentially flat in Wisconsin, and we also hear of prison abuse.
Well, those are both important things to talk about. Prison spending, I think, has been flat, but it's been flat in recent years relative to a long period of sharp increase, multi-decade period of sharp increase. So the fact that correction spending has been flat in recent years is not necessarily something to celebrate. We've got a very high corrections budget compared to historic norms, and it would be good, I think, to bring that down in careful ways that aren't going to compromise public safety. And as I've indicated, I think the experience in other states shows that that you can bring corrections budgets down and corrections populations down without compromising public safety. As far as the juvenile facility issue, that the juvenile system is not something I'm particularly focused on in the book, but I've read the stories about what happened in Wisconsin in the news, as everybody else has, and those are disturbing stories. Those are stories which seem to reflect some real management problems in the institution, and I can only hope that those issues will be addressed. I hope that the new legislature will take a good hard look at what we're doing with juvenile incarceration in the state and consider alternatives.
Let's go to Russell now in Marshall. Hi, Russell.
Hello, and hello to the professor. I worked in the prison system for 20 years. I recently retired. I was a vocational school teacher, and the way the system worked back in the 90s, if a guy was sentenced to, say the judge gave him 10 years, he was eligible for parole in 3.5. And, of course, that's what was publicized, and the people, oh, God, he only got 3.5 years. No, he didn't. He got 10 years. He will be mandatorily released in 7.5 if he behaves himself, and he is eligible to see the board in 3. And rarely does a person get out the first time they see the board. When they when a person arrives in the system, he's evaluated, and they give him hoops to jump through. He's got to get his HSED. He's got to get a vocational training. He's got to have drug treatment. He's got to have marriage counseling, whatever they deem necessary. And until he satisfies all those requirements, the parole board is not going to let him go.
How would you respond, Michael, to that litany of things that must that the prisoner must go through?
Well, Russell is absolutely right about that, and I think that there are some real misconceptions about parole out there. Parole laws establish a range within which prisoners may be released, and it's pretty rare for people to get out at the first available opportunity. And if the parole board is doing its job, the parole board is taking a good, hard look at how the offender is doing in the institution and the rehabilitative progress the offender is making and the likelihood of success on release. I think that the parole systems can work very effectively and be protective of public safety. And when we eliminated parole in Wisconsin, In the 1990s, I think that a lot of the alarmist things that some people were saying about parole at that time were exaggerated. We had a system in place that was a professional system and was evaluating people rather than simply operating as a green light to let people out at the first available opportunity.
Well, let's turn our attention for a moment to the federal level. Yesterday, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker gave this impassioned plea to the Senate to vote against Mr. Trump's nominee for Attorney General and his fellow Senator Jeff Sessions. He said, quote, "The arc of the moral universe does not just naturally curve toward justice. We must bend it." How do you interpret his words?
Well, I don't know the exact context in which that was said, but I do know Senator Booker had concerns about criminal justice reform and whether Senator Sessions would continue reforms that have begun under President Obama and President Obama's first Attorney General, Eric Holder. The federal story over the last few years has been a really fascinating one. The federal prison system has achieved some pretty significant reductions in size over the last 4 or 5 years, and these changes reflect initiatives by the Obama administration. There was very little, though, that was embodied in congressional legislation because, of course, we know President Obama and Congress had a hard time getting legislation passed. So changes that were made, in my view, positive changes that were made in the Obama years are changes that could pretty easily be undone by a new administration. And the fact that Jeff Sessions seems on track to be our next Attorney General is, I think, an indication that the new administration will not be interested in sentencing reform, will not be supportive of sentencing reform, because Senator Sessions' record as a senator is as someone who has been a real critic of sentencing reform proposals. On the federal level, there's been a lot of interesting things that we've seen in recent years. I would not expect those things to continue in the next few years.
Let's take another call now as we talk to Michael O'Hare. He has a new book on sentencing impact, the role of judges have to play here in Wisconsin. Now going to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
In the federal federal and in the state prisons, the recidivism problem. In Japan, they train their people. What I understand, they have the lowest recidivism rate in the world, and they have these training programs. If you're in there for 30 days or 10 years, they train their people. And in our society, I believe there's a lot of racism involved in it, and we don't want our prisoners to get a better education than our regular workers. What do you think about that?
Well, I think first of all, let me say I'm very glad that you mentioned Japan, and I think more generally something that needs to be more part of our criminal justice conversation in this country is international comparisons, because the United States really stands out starkly in comparison with the rest of the world in terms of how we're doing with our violent crime rate, in terms of how we're doing with incarceration, and I think there's probably a lot that we could learn by looking at what other countries are doing. In terms of training programs, education in prisons in this country, in general, things are available, but in general, they are pretty badly underfunded. In most prison systems, you're going to find long waiting lists for inmates to get into programs that provide good vocational training or treatment, drug treatment, mental illness treatment, and so forth. So our programming is really stretched pretty thin in this country. We're not at all generous with that. And I think that that the caller is right that part of what is going on is that there is resistance, very understandable resistance to providing higher levels of social service to criminal offenders in prison than we provide to ordinary citizens on the outside. That's a very understandable intuition. And maybe one of the reasons we see a lot of underfunding of programming for people in prison is that as a country we tend also to be less than generous with funding of education and other kinds of social services for people outside prison as well.
Well, let's return here to Wisconsin as we near the end of our hour. One lesson you offer up is the idea that reform should be grounded in ethical, egalitarian arguments, not just economics. Why is that?
Well, this observation in the book really comes out of my following of the sentencing reform story nationally over the last few years. There has been a big push, more so actually in a lot of other states than Wisconsin. There has been a big push to reform sentences and try to bring down prison populations. And the arguments almost always emphasize economic concerns first and foremost, that we're spending so much on prisons that money could be better spent on other things. I think that's a good argument. It's a point that does need to be made, but I think that argument is also limited. If we're only focusing on economics, there's only so far that we'll get with reform, because at the end of the day, when people think about crime policy and how we should respond to crime through sentences, people are concerned about their safety. And when people are contemplating the possibility that they or a loved one might be the victim of a serious crime, a violent crime or sexual crime, they're willing to pay a lot of money for that, to prevent that from happening. So just to talk about cutting spending on prisons is not enough. And I think specifically, one thing that needs to be part of the conversation to a greater extent is the impact of incarceration on offenders and on their families. And the families of offenders are really practically invisible in national conversations about sentencing reform. We don't.
And very briefly, Michael, are you hopeful for the future of sentencing reform and the ability to deal with mass incarceration?
Actually, not so much in the near term, because you know, neither in Washington D.C. nor in Madison do I think we have a leadership now that's really focused on these issues, particularly. Over the long run, I don't know. I do think that reform will depend on a sense of compassion for other people. And is that growing in our society? Unfortunately, I'm not sure I see a whole lot of evidence of that at present.
We'll leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Michael O'Hare is a professor of law at Marquette University. He blogs at lifesentencesblog.com. He's also the author of forthcoming books, Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era, How Judges Retain Power and Why Mass Incarceration Happened Anyway, and The Failed Promise of Sentencing Reform. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network. Thanks to producer Brianne Chasso for this hour and technical director Michelle Good. Coming up tomorrow at this time, join us as we wrap up the week discussing President-elect Trump's news conference and so many more things in The Week in Review.